Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, are you familiar with the Ignite series? It's a speaker program that started here in Seattle and took off around the world. People you might bump into on the street, often nervous to be on stage for the first time, speak from the heart about their concerns, passions, and knowledge. The possibilities are endless.
I want to encourage everyone in the room that we must be this change. We must be this answer to creating this pipeline of access, this bridge to opportunity for those who may not look like us. It's not about the wall, it's about the bridge. Access, exposure, education, opportunity.
That's Andrew McGee, one of the great speakers this time around. This 10th anniversary episode, Ignite Seattle 31, took place at Town Hall Seattle on November 17th. Thank you to Sonia Harris for our recording. We're presenting our broadcast version of the event here. You'll find the full version and links to individual videos of the talks on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, Ignite MC Scott Birkin kicks off the talks.
We've been doing this for 10 years, and the main reason we've been able to do this is because of all the people who raised their hands, who've come before and told others about it and come back. We started in a very small place. It's no longer around anymore, and the audience and the community we built has grown and grown, and now we are able to sell out a venue as big as this, which is amazing. It's amazing to us. So I want to thank all of you who've come before and told other people about the event. We like to think what we built is a sort of community around storytelling and people who want to come to events where they'll be challenged. You're not sure what you're going to hear. You know you're going to hear things that will surprise you. Some things will be funny. Some stories will be sad. Some stories will, initially you'll think, why do someone's going to talk about that? And by the end, it's the most fascinating subject you've ever heard of. We've cultivated a bunch of people who want to be challenged in that way, and we're grateful that you like what we do. How many of you failed calculus in college? A lot of you? Okay. Well, you're in for a treat. Our opening talk, Jordan Couch is going to talk about happiness through calculus. Please welcome Jordan to the stage.
It's often said that a single good deed can change the world. Well, I'm here tonight to tell you all that that's just bull. But don't worry, as advertised, this is going to be a happy speech. You see, the truth is our world is vast and it's infinitely complex. And as important as individual good deeds are, they're like raindrops in an ocean, and they can never have a lasting impact. But all hope is not lost. Leo Tolstoy said that for a man to live in this world, he must either not see the infinite, or have such an explanation of the meaning of life as to connect the finite with the infinite. In other words, it is possible to have a lasting impact on an infinite world. But first, we must understand the infinite. And what better teacher than Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, the inventor of calculus? You see, in 1675, Leibniz set out to understand the infinite. And in doing so, he did something that no mathematician in all of human history had ever done. He discovered an equation for the area of a circle. And even though this problem had baffled mathematicians for thousands and thousands of years, Leibniz solved it in a proof that was less than one page long. And that's including his multiple doodles. This was the magic of calculus. Impossible problems became easy to solve. And all because Leibniz found a new way of understanding the infinite. So let's do the same thing right here tonight. Take, for example, this equation. 1/2 plus 1/4 plus 1/8 continuing. If we imagine this equation like movement along a line, we can see that with each step we get halfway from where we are to 1. And we can all know that the further along the series we go, the closer we will get to 1, but we can also see that it will never actually equal 1. Add 1/16, 1/32, 1/64, 1/128, on and on and on to infinity, and we keep getting closer, but it never actually equals 1. Never. So, if by definition an infinite series never ends, how do we solve an equation like this one? Well, in 1675, Leibniz took a look at this exact same equation, and he just said, so what if we can't see the end? Doesn't matter. He recognized that in an infinite series, no one segment is different or more important than another. So everything we need to know is right there in that equation. We know where we are, and we know where it's going. So even if we can't see the end, we can say that at its infinite end, it equals 1. And now a lot of people scoffed at Leibniz and his blatant disregard for all mathematical principles that had been accepted at the time. But in the end, iPhones, space travel, most of our modern life has proven that Leibniz was right all along. So tonight I want to challenge all of you to look at our world in the same way we look at that infinite series. You see, our tendency when things happen, whether good or bad, is to seek answers by searching for the powerful leaders who we believe caused it. But in an infinite world, our leaders, like points on that infinite series, aren't special. Take, for example, Napoleon, widely recognized as one of history's greatest leaders. In 1799, Napoleon loudly proclaimed his intent to conquer Britain, and he launched France into a 16-year-long war. Now, in the years following Napoleon's proclamation, the French army marched further and further east, away from Britain and toward Napoleon's eventual defeat. And even as his army marched further and further east, Napoleon continued to proclaim his intent to conquer Britain. So I ask, is this history's greatest leader? Or was Tolstoy right when he said that Napoleon and his generals, above all the blind leaders of history, were the most enslaved and the most involuntary of all men? But Napoleon wasn't alone. Every year, our Supreme Court turns public opinion into binding precedent. Every one of us has seen a time that a law was broken, but not enforced, especially those of you like me who commute on a regular basis. In a world like ours, where trillions of independent actions take place every moment, leaders simply don't exist. And one good deed has no chance of ever changing the world. So with that in mind, I have a challenge for all of you. The next time tragedy strikes, don't ask who is responsible for this. Don't ask, what can I do to fix it? Don't waste your life chasing down individual points on an infinite series, and instead take a cue from Leibniz. Look at what's in front of you. When tragedy strikes, I want all of us to ask ourselves, who am I such that I made this happen? And who do I need to become if I'm going to make this world a better, happier place?
Good job. Very good. It's good stuff. Next up, Noah Ilyinsky is going to talk about guaranteed successful design. Please welcome Noah to the stage.
All right. Guaranteed successful design. Simple but not easy. All you have to do is make sure you're designing the right thing and design it well. We're going to talk about both of those, not in that order. We're going to start with designing it well. You have to separate your function from your implementation. Humans are really bad at this because we're really excited about talking how we're going to implement it. But if you can describe it or if you can point to it, you're talking about implementation and you've narrowed the focus of what is possible because you're thinking about how to do it, not what it can do for you. Start with that first. Abstract your requirements. Nobody wants about this much hot water and about that much cold water. What we want is the right temperature so that we're comfortable in the shower or in the bath, but we're stuck with this physical implementation of these knobs. Really, though, we want the right temperature and some volume. Once you've got that, you can solve the abstraction. You can do it totally in the abstract, in the math. So we've got hot and cold here, making a little point in temperature space. Or you can look at other disciplines that have solved similar related problems and bring them back into your discipline. And then there's a whole lot of ways to implement that function. Track your assumptions. Your assumptions should be really good friends. You should get to know them really well. You should, you know, treat them like trading cards, and then disrupt them. See what you can do if you add new assumptions. See if you can remove assumptions. Really try to undermine your thinking there. Introduce constructive constraints. My favorite crusade these days is get rid of dropdowns. They're a terrible, terrible piece of UI, and you almost always should never use them. Just don't. We like constraints. People in a garage. A lot of constraints makes you be more creative. It's a really good way to think differently. Think outside the box. You can't. That's why it's your box. If you get with other people, they have boxes too. If the people who look like you, their boxes are going to look like your box, and you don't get a much bigger box. The more different the people you work with are, the more different the collective bigger box is going to be. Data is great. Refining into information is better. You can get some answers out of that. That's even better. Enabling actions is great. Doing it just completely, solving it for people is even better. Work up in the upper end. Taking data and information is good, but you haven't really solved the problem. When you get to GLAD, then you're good. Architect for use. Menus are not organized alphabetically. They're usually not organized by price. They're not organized by calorie or ingredients. They're organized in the way that the human is going to consume the food typically. It actually turns out it's sort of time ordered. Don't just spew your database onto the screen. Draw a map. Otherwise, you're just building a house without a blueprint, and that's a bad idea. there's going to be edge cases. Things are going to go wrong. Do you remember Google's April Fool's trick or Microsoft's chatbot? Horrific failures because they didn't think about edge cases and real damage was done. Think about the edge cases. Design systems for human inaction. If your system depends on a human doing the right thing, your system's going to fail. Seriously, it's going to fail eventually. This is why we love direct deposit, because it does the right thing when you don't do anything. If you wait for the human to do something, it's going to screw up once in a while. All right, switching tracks, defining the right problem. Keep a bug list and keep a resignation list. Like, man, traffic in Seattle is really, really annoying and housing's really expensive. Oh, well. Or maybe those are things that we can fix. That's how you find solutions, the right problems to work on. Root cause analysis, actually ask why and dive into that. When you hear the passive voice, people just keep dying in car accidents. We call them accidents. They're not accidents, not in 30,000 a year. That's not an accident. That's a plan. When you hire a passive voice, ask who's doing it. Make a visual map of the market. I saw this, not this one, but one very much like this many, many years ago, and there was a big gap that was filled with things like Twitter and Facebook that didn't previously exist, but in 2008 were coming into being. You can do a really interesting analysis of what exists by making some interesting axes. This is a technique called Wardley mapping by a guy named Simon Wardley. This is, the future is inevitable. We know how different resources are going to go from being these very custom boutique things to becoming essentially utilities. You can map out entire industries that way. Pursue bigger boxes. We're in a tiny little box, a tiny little box. There's a whole planet's worth of problems out there, and we're not looking, most of us, not very far outside our tiny little box to find the right problems to solve. Tim O'Reilly for years has been talking about working on stuff that matters. What that means is work on things that matter more than money. Not that there's no money involved, but that there's more purpose there. Create more value than you capture, so you're net positive in the world, and take the long view. The next quarter or the next release, not long enough. Here's the best work on stuff that matters recruiting line in the history of technology. This is how Steve Jobs hired John Sculley. Sculley later fired Jobs. That's beside the point. Brett Victor is an amazing designer. Somebody asked him, what should designers be doing after he ranted that we were doing the wrong things, we weren't focused on the right things, and he wrote this beautiful essay on what technologists can do to combat the single biggest problem we face, which is climate change. It's a wonderful set of resources and about 1,000 good ideas. Go check it out. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a quick bit of... So this is our 10th anniversary. So when I get a moment, I'm gonna interject a little bit of Ignite Seattle trivia. How many of you were here when that gentleman got married on the stage? Okay. We love to push the boundaries of this format, and we love to find new ways to use this format. We only get 5 minutes. What can you do in 5 minutes? So if you're thinking about talks, we are open-minded about what can be done on stage, preferably PG-13. Okay. Next up. So Noah's an alumni, obviously. Our next speaker is also an alumni speaker. Kristen Leong is going to talk to you about Definitely Not Nordstrom. Please welcome Kristen to the stage.
Ignite! I am psyched to be back here, you guys. I don't know what you guys have been doing, but I've had like a rough last couple of weeks, right? And it's our birthday. You guys, Ignite is 10 years old. This is a big deal. That's like ancient in startup years, right? I'm a middle school teacher, so we're going to start with the agenda. We're going to cover 4 things today. We're going to start with a story, and then you're going to get to make a judgment call. I'm going to tell you about some of my favorite people. We're going to end with something we all can do together. Let's talk about the grocery store. Guys, I hate going to the grocery store. The lighting is really bad. There's too many options for everything. The music. You'd be like choosing between 87 varieties of peanut butter, and you have to stop and say hello right back to Lionel Richie. What? There's like pressure to look your best. But actually, my story today is about a time that I rejected this pressure. I go to yoga after work because I'm a middle school teacher and you have to go to yoga after work. I was unprepared though, so I found myself, I had to go grocery shopping and I was wearing like sweatpants and like this disgusting sweaty yoga shirt and like my fanciest teacher shoes, which like, whatever. I was going for like teacher athleisure. It's fine. So I was getting ready to go into the grocery store in this outfit, and I remembered that stores here are at like Arctic levels. So I went back to my car, and I grabbed the only long sleeve shirt that I had, which was my 7-year-old son's thermal. And while I was there, I remembered, thankfully, that I love the earth. I grabbed the only bag that I had. It was a Nordstrom shopping bag that I have been reusing since like 2005. And this is how I shopped at like peak after work hours in Bellevue. And it's fine. Because, like, whatever, right? Who cares? Until it's not fine. And then I was putting some frozen chicken into my Nordstrom bag. And I had this moment of, like, realizing that people could see me. You know? Like, do you ever have that where life just kind of dawns on you? So then I was having this existential crisis in the grocery store. And I was wondering out loud, like, who am I? How have my life choices taken me here? But I realized this was going to be an awesome story to tell my family and my students and apparently 900 of all of you. And a funny thing happened in the retelling of this story. I realized that, guys, I wasn't having a crisis. This is actually like my best self. Each part of that outfit represents a part of my life that I love. When I told my students this story, a 7th grader told me I was a hero, and I get it because we tell kids all the time to be themselves, to express themselves. But as we all know, the world is a really scary place to be yourself, especially if you're a middle school kid. Maybe some of you can relate to that fear now, especially if you're a person of color, or if you're queer, or if you're Muslim, or if you're an immigrant, or if you're a woman, or if you're like a sort of aware, straight, white guy who works in tech. Whatever. For some of us, this fear is fresh, and for some of us, this fear is familiar, but for all of us now, it is a brave act of rebellion and self-preservation just to be yourself out in public. So the point of this story is, wear whatever you want to the grocery store and love yourself and love each other, right? And tell your story to whoever will listen in whatever language you can tell it best, even if you're still crying, even if you're still angry, because the only way we're going to make it through the next 4 years is if we are out in force being exactly who we are. Thank you. I'm Kristen Leong. Find me on Twitter. We're still stronger together. Thank you.
That was worthy of a lot of applause. That's good. Good amount of applause there. Thank you very much. So next up is another alumni. How many remember the talk you saw a year or so ago about surviving the mega earthquake survival skills by Eric? We're very pleased we submitted another talk. Now, Kristen mentioned language. She offered how language is important towards the end of her talk about the language we use. So this next talk is about language used in ordinary daily life. We forget how we can overlook the use of words. If we're more precise with words, we might be able to get more out of our lives. And so Eric's going to talk about not everything is a collaboration. Please welcome Eric to the stage.
Hello, Seattle. Okay, I, Napoleon Eric Holdeman, first want to declare that I intend to invade the island nation of Vashon. But before that, we do that, we need to go to Spokane. But we're talking about collaboration. There are buzzwords in our life and society. If you're old enough, I mean, everything was a new paradigm. You didn't say separate, you'd say bifurcate. We need our kids to have grit. But the buzzword now is collaborate. And when I first heard this word in the form we talk about today, I didn't like it. A collaborator was a Quisling, which is the name of the guy who collaborated with the Nazis in Norway. What are you laughing about? Now, collaboration has a lot of different meanings. To the man, he's saying, hey, baby, want to come back to my place and copulate? But, okay, think about how collaboration is used. Some people say they're collaborating when they inform. Inform only means I'm telling you something. I don't expect you to do anything. We're not going to do anything together. Coordination actually is a two-way form of communication. I'm going to tell you something. I'd like to know what you're doing, but we aren't necessarily going to copulate later. You know, it's just plain coordination. Partnering, now you're getting to the point where we're going to start working together. You have a common interest, you know, corporate-wise, you have partnerships, really starting to work on common issues of common concern. Now, think about negotiate. Some people may think that collaboration means we're going to negotiate, have give and take from that perspective. So be sure and clarify when someone says they want to collaborate with you. What does that mean? Does it mean negotiation? Now, this is my only Donald Trump reference, but Donald Trump, when he thinks about negotiation, he may be thinking about tit for tat. Now, think about that. Where you give and I take. But collaborate really is the highest form of interaction with between people and organizations. No perceived agendas, and really getting in there, blank sheet of paper, start with that, that's collaboration. Now this is a true, I was in the Army in early 70s, we'd say, I want you to go over there and get in bed with them on this. Back then it wasn't don't ask, don't tell, it was just plain don't. And so it really meant close coordination. And remember when someone says, I want to collaborate with you, they may be looking to share the blame with someone from that standpoint, or they're afraid of taking too much risk. A key component of collaboration is trust. Without trust, there will be no collaboration. Be sure you start to build trust. And how do you do that? It really starts with that first thing we covered in the beginning is sharing information. If you're working with someone who doesn't trust you, you can keep sharing information. You're not expecting them to do anything, but after a while, because you're giving them information, they'll say, well, okay, this is all right, doesn't demand anything from me. You can move from that to coordination. I'm doing this, how would you like to join me? It's invitational to be able to achieve that. And then, you know, the clock keeps ticking. They're partnering! So, look for opportunities, partner with others. I actually worked with Pierce County when I was in King County. They didn't trust King County. Even I didn't trust King County. But I gave them a bunch of money, and they said, we'll do it. Okay, going to talk about one other thing, and that is, my bad. Your parents did not send you to a university education so you could go around saying, my bad. That's true. Yeah. All right, Canadians. I know there's a Canadian in here. Now, and you don't have to be ashamed. Half these people want to go to Canada already. But they don't say, my bad. They say, sorry. When Canada and Canadians start saying, my bad, you know it's the end of Western civilization. Okay, verify your intentions before speaking. Are you looking to inform, coordinate, partner, negotiate, collaborate, copulate? Or just say my bad, I guess. But don't say it. Now, this is audience participation at this point. Got to throw it in here. We don't do it automatically. We don't get rid of my bad. So on behalf of the 325 million people in the United States to the 7 billion people of the world, we would like at this point to apologize by saying all in unison. All right, thank you.
So now that we know the true meaning of the word collaborate, it's an excellent segue into Sarah Shack's talk. She's going to talk to you about Appy Bride, how I infuriated the wedding industry and got my dream wedding. Please welcome Sarah to the stage.
I heard a lot during wedding planning. You seem really calm about this. And it was true. I was calm about wedding planning. I had taken back my wedding from the wedding industry and decided to do it our own way with my fiance and I. And it was different than most American weddings. American weddings, we focus on picture perfect, the perfect dress. Oh, look at that venue, those flowers, they're like the prettiest shade of rose, right? And we focus on so much the perfect Pinteresty wedding. We don't see how much it's going to cost us. The average American wedding is over $30,000, and you as a guest cost the couple over $200. Women now getting ready for their wedding don't just buy a several thousand dollar dress. They also go out for plastic surgery and other things to make them look like the perfect bride they feel like they should be. And I rejected this notion of an expensive wedding and being perfect at the expense of also who we were authentically. And I ended up writing a blog post about this on Medium. I thought like a couple hundred people would read it. It went viral, and I ended up in the Daily Mail of the UK called, "Is This America's Thriftiest Bride?" Yes. And we had a budget that was less than a third of the average American wedding. And so when I wrote this blog post and went viral, the wedding industry responded. They said a lot of things, like they would crash my wedding and show how horrible it was. But they also, I thought, was an interesting point where they talked about how they charge more for an event that's a wedding because you expect perfection and they have to deliver that on that one special day. And I think that this is a real ratcheting up of expectation in this vicious cycle where we seek the glamour and perfection of this one day of our wedding, and we're willing to pay anything to make it happen. And the industry knows that. In The Power of Glamour, they talk about how glamour and ideas of glamour shape our perceptions and our wants and needs. But I decided I was going to ditch glamour in the pursuit of joy. I was going to honor our values as a couple and our bank account, and that this was going to be as simple a wedding as I could make it to also meet kind of our cultural norms as a family merging together from two countries. So in ditching glamour, does anybody know this book? Like, you pile stuff in the living room, and then you're like, doesn't bring me joy, toss. Like, that's what I did with the wedding industry. So if it was a tradition that didn't fit, I walked down the aisle by myself to a cellist playing EXO by Beyonce. It was fantastic. Anybody who judges, so many things that just didn't feel authentically us. And then I honored our values. I work in the nonprofit industry. I love Seattle with a deep passion. We had two wedding venues for about the fifth of the price of another wedding venue and supported two amazing historic nonprofits on Seattle's waterfront. We went and got, we decoupled catering from the venue, so getting veggie grilled to cater, which was amazing, and then some excellent salmon from Whole Foods. Things from the sharing economy, and buy nothing groups like this signage. So this is what things cost us. That designer purse was free from Rent the Runway. It was fantastic. I went to actually a drag convention, RuPaul's Drag Convention. It's the best place to get wedding accessories, and I got Ashley Nell Tipton's like amazing Project Runway flower thing for my hair. It was amazing. Anyway, and then to keep things simple, what I did is this. We had a playbook. Anybody who was working the wedding could tear out a page and execute. They didn't need to know something special for themselves. We lined up deliveries using services like Livable. We got wine kegs. Wine kegs, people. $2 a glass, self-serve, amazing. And if friends volunteered, great. I put them on something fun and small, but I hired staff from the gig economy to do so. All the plans were super visual and laid out, so images help you plan and adjust. And then we kept things really simple with things like a DIY photo booth with Polaroids. It was an amazing album of photos that friends and family left for us. So in ditching glamour to gain joy, and honoring our values and keeping things simple, we had an amazing wedding that many people here in the audience took part in and made happen. And it felt authentic and us and our community. And we only went slightly over budget. I love the day, but I also love the process of planning. And I didn't feel stressed, and it was really good. So I'm taking the blog post and the experience of event planning and writing a book called Happy Bride, The Modern Wedding Guide, which will be available on Kindle in February 27. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter at Sarah Schott and eventually on the egg page of Happy Bride. Thanks.
The next two talks are locally themed, which is great. We think we know our city. We live here a long time. There's a lot we don't know, stuff we don't know that's going on and stuff we don't know about the past. First up is stuff that's going on. Philip Dang is going to talk to you. The title of his talk is Breaking Bad. I'm sorry. Let me back up. Master of Ceremonies Fail. Let me back up. Local. Next two talks are going to be local. One's going to be about the past. One's going to be about the present. This talk's about the past. Philip Dang is going to talk about breaking bread and breaking boundaries. Please welcome Philip to the stage.
So town hall's the perfect venue for my talk because we're in a beautiful historic building that's been transformed into a beloved community and civic space. And I'm here to say, let's do it again. In 2013, the city of Seattle finished $55 million worth of renovations at King Street Station, which sits in the heart of our city at one of the most transit-connected hubs on the entire West Coast. Every day, about 384,000 people move through this area, but almost none of them ever go inside King Street because it's been mostly empty this whole time, like it's been waiting for something. Before I tell you what that is, I want to take you to a neighborhood not too far from here called Yesler Terrace. This was Seattle's first low-income housing development, and it's still home to a large Somali refugee community. In 2012, I was working as a community organizer in Yesler, and I met a Somali woman who was cooking one of the most delicious stews I have ever smelled out in her backyard on a barbecue. And unfortunately, smelling it was as far as I ever got, because I asked her, I said, where can I try this? She just smiled and said, sorry, nowhere. There are no restaurants. We just make this at home for our families and for our community. So I don't know if y'all see where I'm starting to go, but we have this woman and thousands of other people like her with incredible culinary talent most of us don't have access to, and communities that are struggling to start their own restaurants. We also have 10,000 square feet of empty space on a street level of a beautifully restored historic landmark in the heart of our city. So hopefully you're starting to see Seattle's first international street food market at King Street Station. We're talking about a place where, regardless of how you vote or worship or the language you speak or how much money you make, we all have to eat. And we're all there because the food is delicious and diverse and interesting. But more than that, for the 10 vendors that we envision in this space, they're part of a business incubator program designed by our organization specifically to help low-income immigrant and refugee cooks revive culinary careers they left behind in their home countries. We're talking about economic opportunity to people and families and communities that really need it. So this is a pretty special vision, and it's pretty tough to pull off. There's only one group that can do it. Yeah, it's us. It's this community. Because truly public institutions come from the people. We're in a great example of one right now. But Pike Place, the University of Washington, all of these institutions were built to meet our community's needs, and they're entrusted to us to maintain. So that's what Market Share and the campaign for King Street is. We're a nonprofit with a mission to unite our community to build Seattle's next great civic icon, a once-in-a-generation chance. The city owns the station. It's a public space. The mayor has committed public funds for construction, and the Office of Economic Development is getting ready to request proposals. And a lot of private interests are lining up next to us. But Market Share's philosophy is rooted in the people. We care about the bottom line and have meticulous plans, but we care the most about 10 people out there who need a chance to realize that American dream. A lot has changed in the last 2 weeks. But the way forward has not. American life is still about building our society each day on a foundation of optimism and compassion and shared opportunity. and King Street Station has stood vacant for 3 years, waiting, I believe, for this moment to become our statement at a time when we are called to respond. So I'm saying, let us build together as a community a living and enduring monument to our ideals, to our values, and to the basic notion that we are not just better together, but we love living together. So if you've been asking yourself recently, what's next? Tonight, connect with Market Share, because we just have a few weeks left to claim King Street for our community, to turn it into a symbol of who we really are. Thank you.
Good stuff. So speaking of this word, community, I heard a rumor, not entirely sure that it's true, I heard a rumor that there's going to be an after party tonight. You know, rumors, you know, we Facebook news, fake things go by all the time, but I think this one might be true. The Quarter Lounge is a bar. It's just off the street. It's a wonderful dive bar. We've been there many times, but any of you who want to join us and the speakers and the organizers for a beer and celebrate this great night, you're welcome after our last talk to head over there, and there'll be stuff and entertainment, and we can, maybe I'll take off the red pants, and you'll see what's underneath. Who knows? We'll see how, the gentleman over there, we'll see what happens. Who knows? Getting back on track with a serious topic, we spend a lot of our time not observing things. Our brains are meant to filter stuff out, and we live in cities that have so much history. Why is this street named after Denny? Why is this park named after this person? We just tune it all out. So I'm really excited about this next talk. She's going to teach us about how to pay more attention and give us some context to all the things we don't notice all the time. So the next talk, Amy Cash, she's going to talk about the streets where you live. Please welcome Amy to the stage.
So, I work as a tour guide, and sometimes I give tours to kids. And the great thing about that is they'll send you thank you cards. Yeah, I got one recently from a girl named Zoe. She wrote, "I learned that there is a new Seattle." And I thought, yeah, in our 160-some-odd year history, there have been a lot of new Seattles. But all of those Seattles have contained, in some form or another, all of the problems we face today. In 1889, as the city rebuilt from its great fire, the Seattle PI wrote that the extent of building going on at the present time is inconceivable to those who are not within its very midst. Well, I think they could have written that yesterday. And I think knowing our history can be a comfort in changing times. We can take some inspiration from the past and focus on our obligations to the future. Now, the early Seattleites thought a lot about the future. This is Belltown in 1910. yeah, if you squint, you can see shorties, I think. They brought water down from the Cedar River, they built a university, and then sent the president paddling around Puget Sound trying to find some students. They also did some terrible things. This wasn't great for the environment, and there was racism and poverty and homelessness and addiction. But there were people who tried to solve those problems, like Emma Ray. She was born into slavery. She helped her alcoholic husband to quit drinking, and she then proceeded to help as many of the city's destitute and addicted as she could, including the grandson of Chief Seattle. She visited prisons and took newly released prisoners into her home, and she worked with another woman, Olive Ryther, to care for abandoned and orphaned children. Now, neither Emma nor Olive discriminated as far as who they would help, but of course there was a lot of discrimination to go around. Just as Emma was retiring from her life in public service, a group of white businessmen were pushing successfully for laws to keep Asian Americans from owning land. 20 years later, some of those same men lobbied Congress for the internment of Japanese Americans in World War II. The very first people in the country to be sent away left from Bainbridge Islands. thousands followed, with the full support of our mayor, who said he feared they might otherwise burn this town down and bring on something that would dwarf Pearl Harbor. A senior at UW named Gordon Hirabayashi said no. He refused to comply with curfews or register for exclusion, and he appealed his criminal convictions to the Supreme Court. He lost. But 40 years later, his case was overturned, and he said then that if you think the Constitution is a good one, and if you think it protects you, you had better make sure it's actively operating, because otherwise it's a scrap of paper. I learned about Hirabayashi from a play. There's lots of ways to learn history. I like to play the game of who is this named for. Cal Anderson Park was named for our first openly gay state legislator. He fought to add he fought to add sexual orientation to the state's anti-discrimination law, and when the bill failed by one vote in 1994, he said he hoped it would energize people to go out and fight bigotry and hate so that their little victory would be short-lived. He died a year later. The bill passed in 2006, and earlier this week, hundreds of students met in that park to express their views on bigotry and hate. And skip this slide. If you've wondered what the volunteers of Volunteer Park were volunteering for, it was the Spanish-American War. That's the one Joseph Pulitzer took credit for starting through his sensationalist news stories. But finally, everyone's favorite semi-functional phallic machine, Bertha. This was named for our first and only female mayor, Bertha Knight Landis. She ran, yeah, she ran a strong administration and did most of what she promised, and was widely endorsed for re-election. She lost to a man with no experience who refused to debate her, saying that he would not answer the questions encased in her pent-up bosom, as it is manifestly hard for any man to make debate with a hostile or infuriated woman. That was him in the picture there. He promised jobs for everyone 1 year before the start of the Great Depression, and he mainly distinguished himself by being our second mayor to be recalled from office and our second mayor named Frank. So nothing is new. Everything comes back. Problems persist. But I think what our history teaches us is that we have the power to decide what part we want to play and what we want our city and our community and our future to be, because we are not living at the end of history. We're right in the middle of it. Thank you.
Great job. Good stuff. Good stuff.
Having fun? Good? You're on the home stretch. You're on the home stretch. You're on the home stretch. A little bit longer to go before the quarter lounge. Beer in your hand. Now, there's so many things that go on at these events. We love the juxtaposition and forcing you to think about things from different perspectives. And something's happy, something's sad, something you don't know what to do with. And I'm really excited about our last talk tonight because it brings a lot of it, all of it together, both as the audience and how we challenge you and the challenges that speakers face at getting up on a stage like this. So it's our last speaker of the night. Maybe our best, we'll see. I think it will be. Andrew McKee is going to talk about how great things never come from comfort zones. Please welcome Andrew to the stage.
Go get it, man. Go get it.
Emmett Till, young 14-year-old boy from Mississippi, brutally murdered a white family after he had flirted with a white woman. Face disfigured. Dumped in the ocean. His mother did something that was very powerful. She called for an open casket so that everybody could be exposed to what happened to Emmett while he was in Mississippi. Look at your neighbor and say, exposure. Say it again, exposure. So growing up in Mississippi, there's a lot of things that I wasn't exposed to. But one thing I was exposed to was things like poverty, things like struggle, things like hopelessness. My mother, who came from a family of she lost her parents by the time she was 20 years old, both parents from cancer, lost two of her sisters, both dead, gone. Big family, and our pastor, we missed our little great family picture there. No degree, but was able to come back and graduate after understanding that exposure was a powerful thing. And my brother, who we just saw, and these slides are going really, really fast, who we just saw, was the first one to graduate from Mississippi. And we created this bridge of exposure and access, this bridge of understanding that greatness is not building a wall, but it's actually building a bridge. It's building a bridge to access. Joe DeForest, who was a good friend of mine, I played football, and this guy recruited me. He did not look like me. He did not look like me, but he saw some potential. He saw something great inside of me that I didn't see in myself. He did not look like me, but he was a white man, and I was a young black boy. But he saw something that changed something in me, and it showed me perspective, and it gave me exposure. I broke my neck at Oklahoma State, one of the most difficult things I've ever been through. After going and getting recruited out of Mississippi, being exposed to something that was brand new to me, coming from difficult situations, exposed to great friends, new environments, saw education for the first time, what it really looked like outside of Mississippi, equal opportunities, equal access, was given opportunity that I didn't know about, that I wasn't sure of, that I was able to really walk into. I want to encourage everyone in the room that we must be this change. We must be this answer to creating this pipeline of access, this bridge to opportunity for those who may not look like us. It's not about the wall. It's about the bridge. Access, exposure, education, opportunity. These are a great family of mine. I call them my Stillwater family, my white family, who took me in when I didn't have anyone in Oklahoma. That's something that we all can do. We look at this world, and we're all in this difficult place, and we're all fearful. We're all scared about what's going to happen if the change is inside of us. That's why we're here at Ignite Seattle. That's why we're here, is if we ignite Seattle, we can ignite the world. We can change the world. We can change it. We can change it. When I was 14, this is why the story of Emmett Till means so much to me. When I was 14, I had a large group of friends, some white, some black. I ended up dating a young lady who didn't look like me. I got called by a man while I was at work and said, "I'm coming for you. I have my gun, and I'm going to shoot you down dead." That's why the story of Emmett Till means so much to me. That's why understanding what his mother did, the exposure that she chose she knew that she had to do something that was so uncomfortable that would change the perspective of everyone that came in contact with his face. That's my mother there, who came from the family of nothing. Two parents gone, two sisters gone, no education. We started getting education. She came back to graduate. She came back to create this pipeline for us to see something that's great. It was not difficult for her. It was not difficult for many of us. Everybody can be great because everybody can serve. That's my message to this room, is we all can be great because we all can serve. Service brings sacrifice. We have to shake ourselves, get uncomfortable, embrace the discomfort. We talk about growth mindset all the time. America is not about making America great again. It's about the fact that we may not be as great as we thought we were yet. Yet. Not about color. It's about us being willing to step out of our comfort zone, sacrifice, serve, everybody, all kids, all students, all people. Thank you. Great job. Great
job. Thank you, folks. So we want to keep this going forever. We think this is an important forum. So please tell other people about it, tweet about it, write on Facebook about it, and submissions are open. So we want to see you up here next time. Thank you and good night. Thank you.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum featuring Ignite Seattle 31. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.